Yeah, let's do it. I'm pumped. Let's let the healing begin.
God help you if you use voiceover in your work, my friends. God help you. It's flaccid, sloppy writing.
I don't want you to be the guy in the PG-13 movie everyone's really hoping makes it happen. I want you to be like the guy in the rated R movie, you know? The guy you're not sure whether or not you like yet.
Hello and welcome to this week's edition of the Get Your Film Fix podcast. As always, I'm Jeremy Fisk, joined by Lee Carlo and Chapin Hemingway. Today we're going to take a look at this year's Best Picture winner at the Oscars, Guillermo del Toro's The Shape of Water. Then we're going to talk about how Hollywood is in love with itself and how many of their own films or subject matters go on to do very well at the Academy Awards, like The Shape of Water. And then we're going to end it with our top five scenes involving water.
If I told you about her, the princess without voice, what would I say?
Eliza, come on. Eliza, hurry.
She deaf?
Mute, sir. She can hear you.
You clean that lab, you get out.
This may very well be the most sensitive asset ever to be housed in this facility.
You may think that thing looks human. Stands on two legs, right? But we're created in the Lord's image.
All right, so Del Toro's The Shape of Water. We have a very romanticized tale of a woman who, against all odds, found love with a creature not of her kind. Isn't that nice?
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
It's set against the backdrop of the Cold War, where America's love for cinema and musicals could overpower any adversity. Now, my question to you guys, were you able to take that nostalgic sort of fantastical journey with these characters, or were you left wondering how on earth we're watching a world where tap dancing and human on fish fucking exists?
We should just end the podcast there.
Okay.
This is good radio.
To you guys.
Yeah, I mean, I was able, yes, I would say yes, I was able to
buy into this world. It wasn't too tonally off for you that you could dive in, no pun intended.
Yeah, no, I mean, I wasn't thrown off by the tone, really, or whatever the specifics of the fantasies. I kind of was thinking about this movie and how to describe it. And you know how they used to say, and maybe they still do, about Pixar movies being like kids' movies that adults will enjoy too. I kind of felt like Shape of Water was like the inverse of that. It's, you know, it's like essentially an adult movie. It's rated R. It's about adults. It's about adult subject matter. But I think like a kid would enjoy it just as much as an adult would. Similar, you know, sort of the inverse of the Pixar situation, where, you know, like, you really, I think, at its best, you really see the sort of whimsical, childlike, you know, essence that Del Toro brings to this movie. I think there's like an innocence to it, and like you identified, Jeremy, like a nostalgic, you know, sort of feeling to it that I think was at least what I responded most to in the movie.
Yeah, I mean, I liked the
the fantasy element of it. I think Guillermo del Toro is good at that, and I like movies that do that, that can kind of integrate this fantastical element, this you know, otherworldly element into reality, especially dealing with, you know, a something that really happened, you know, dealing with the Cold War, you know, dealing with discussions of the space race, and I think the movie did a good job with that, and I definitely bought into that aspect. I think where I struggled a little bit more was just the telling of the story as a whole. Like, I actually kind of ranked three things in this movie, and in this order, I found that it was an allegory first, it was a tribute to old Hollywood and monster movies second, and then third, or last, however you want to put it, it was an interesting love story. So even though I kind of did buy into it tonally and bought into the story, I don't think it was really the best part of the movie. I thought it was actually maybe the weakest part of the movie.
Well, what did you find it to be an allegory for?
Well, I mean, it's definitely, I mean, it takes place in the 60s, but it's very topical. I mean, it deals with themes of intolerance, and I mean, there's, you know, there's two lines of dialogue in particular. One that Michael Shannon says when he says that, you know, man was created in God's image, you know, referring basically to himself and not to Octavia Spencer, who's black, and a woman. And then you obviously have the intolerance of this creature that's different. And Eliza kind of puts herself in that category by saying she's incomplete, she's not human. And, you know, so there's a lot of themes that I think are very topical, to things that we're dealing with today. And so I think the entire movie is an allegory for that.
Yeah, well, it's weird because when I watched this in the theater when it first came out, and I came away from it enjoying it to some extent, but also being disturbed by it and being upset by it, and I couldn't really pinpoint why the first time I watched it. So rewatching it this time, I think my problem with it, and it goes to your point, Lee, is, you know, this movie dealing with such dark and disturbing and tough topics. I mean, everything from sort of a fetishism of silence, the actual violence in it, talks about homosexuality, there's racism. There's a lot that this movie's trying to pack in and that Del Toro's trying to pack into this movie. And there's a glossiness to how it's dealt with that feels a bit, I guess the word's inappropriate. And I couldn't figure out when I first saw it, what was that inappropriateness or what was that nagging feeling I had. But I think that was it. I think it was that it tries to stuff all these very important, very adult topics into a movie that its resolution to all these topics is a whimsical story or a whimsical song and dance, and something just didn't feel connected there, and it left me feeling like something's wrong here. And I think, you know, that's kind of where I've been able to pinpoint it to.
I mean, I think that's a challenge with this movie. I mean, you're either going to be comfortable with where this story goes or you're not.
It wasn't about the story. It was about how it was almost like, and I like Del Toro and I think he's an excellent filmmaker, but I just feel like there was some sort of like he felt so full of himself and his capabilities to be able to put all these things under one sort of microscope and also gloss it over as a sort of, you know, love letter to Hollywood. And it's like, which one is it? You know, Hollywood can't save, like, the answer to all these tough questions is not It is not a musical or a tap dance or anything like that. And I felt like there was a disconnect there, and it felt weird for me.
Yeah, I think maybe we have a similar issue with the movie and maybe are just articulating it or saw it differently, because I'm sort of with you, and I think that was kind of my point where I was saying that, you know, it's an allegory first, a tribute second, and then the story comes third. Like, if he wants to, you know, show these themes and make these statements and points, and then pay tribute to old Hollywood, the story he told maybe wasn't the one to do it. And I think maybe you had an issue more with it tonally and visually.
I didn't have any issue with the visuals. I thought it was visually stunning.
So the interesting thing is that, like, when it came to the story, is that I actually bought into the relationship and I bought into what Del Toro was doing, but I wasn't left feeling anything. Like, I wasn't, you know, happy that they got together, for lack of a better example, you know. So I think there is where it missed. And then if that's not working, if you're not having an emotional reaction to that, then you're sort of just kind of, you know, watching for, you know, a propaganda film, for lack of a better word. Like, it's kind of hitting you over the head with a lot of these themes, and you're not really enjoying anything along the way.
Yeah, I mean, like, I don't know, just an example of a sort of microcosm of how it all works in that movie is, like, is the scene where Richard Jenkins' character ends up walking in on Sally Hawkins' character and the creature being intimate. And so basically, if you put yourself in Richard Jenkins... Well, no, if you just put yourself in his, like, in his head, basically he's like, oh, look, there's that guy fish that ate my cat and he's currently fucking my neighbor. And then he just laughs and he's like, life's great.
Oh, but I liked that about the movie, how it didn't question, it didn't have characters like questioning the reality of it, because Octavia Spencer even has a similar reaction.
I'm not
even
talking about the reality of it. I'm just talking, yeah.
She even has, Octavia Spencer's character, Zelda, even has a similar reaction when Sally Hawkins tells her that they had sex with each other, and she's just like, oh, like, that's interesting. It sort of makes this, like, joke about men and their penises and, like, how they always just want to have sex. And I like that about this. Another
classic
movie that did that really well was Her, that Joaquin Phoenix movie, when he has a relationship with his operating system. And there's a scene in that movie where he tells Amy Adams, I think it's Amy Adams, that he's in a relationship, and she's just happy for him that he's in a loving relationship. They don't question that it's with a computer. And you have a similar idea here, and I just kind of like that. I like that just acceptance of, you know, the world that these characters live in.
I do too. I think that I like that about the movie. I think that's really it's smart. It's sort of it's like an efficient way to tell the story, right? We don't get hung up on these sort of unimportant things. But I wonder if you guys are, at least Jeremy, I wonder if you're, I mean, I'm not taking anything away from the fact that you felt this movie was, would you describe it as maybe inappropriate in a way, dealing with
exactly inappropriate in that way.
I guess my problem with what you're saying there is that, like, I just felt first and foremost this movie was like a monster movie. You know, this was the sort of the childlike take on the story. I mean, there were these other elements, of course, these more topical elements that you described, but that they were not the central focus of the movie. And weirdly enough, I think what informed me the most of that was, like, just looking at, like, oh, just, I hate using this term, but, like, the mise-en-scene, right? Like, just, like, everything about it was, like, exaggerated. This, like, the, you know, like, you had a fairly, you know, in other areas, realistic representation of the Cold War, but then you had these, you know, this, like, kind of absurd set, you know, like a beautiful set, but one that was very, you know, kind of grand and extravagant and exaggerated, and you know, the stuff with the Cadillac, that kind of stuff. It was, to me, that really informed me as to what kind of movie this was going to be, or what Del Toro wanted the movie to be, which was that it was more erring on that side of being more fantasy than you know, commentary.
I agree, and I think that he wanted it to be that, but he also really took a lot of effort to put these other elements of the film into it, and you can't just like ignore it. I mean, even if you just want to like look at the violence for example, I mean, it's a pretty gruesome movie. And if that was the only like dichotomy, I think I'd be totally fine with it, but it's the piling on of all these other sort of issues onto what, like you say, he essentially wants to be this fun monster movie. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And don't get me wrong. Like, I don't think there's anything essentially wrong with that. I just feel like it didn't work and left me uneasy. And that's just how I responded to the film because of that sort of dichotomy. I don't think it's necessarily, you know, something he should have avoided or, you know, maybe pared down a little bit. But as a viewer, something was unsettling in a way that I don't know if he wanted it to be that unsettling.
Hmm. What do you think, Lee?
Well, I'm thinking a little bit about what you were saying with kind of all the elements with like the Cadillac, and you know, in particular Michael Shannon's character, who I didn't particularly think was a strong suit of the movie. I like Michael Shannon, but
he's the good guy, right?
Yes, Yeah, I like Michael Shannon, but I didn't think his character was particularly well defined. However, he definitely was kind of like I thought that whole element with him and the Cadillac, and like even like the elements with the old movie theater, and I read something about the color palette in the movie kind of matching those old monster movies, and the fact that the movie theater was always empty, I think was all kind of back to this whole idea, this metaphor that he was trying to create, that like this is a dying breed. And you know, Michael Shannon, I mean, he, you know, there's a really obvious metaphor of it with his rotting fingers, you know, coming off, and like he's kind of like disappearing. And I think like he's that character that is intolerant, and you know, I think all of that and that like 60s way of thinking is going away, and that's where what I kind of took from there. Jeremy, did you happen to pick up on the same idea that they use, that we use in Through the Woods, with the cut on your neck with the fingers rotting?
Oh, getting worse and worse.
Yeah, brilliant.
Yeah, they did it much better.
Yeah, they did. Way better.
Like, what did you guys, and I'm asking this because I don't really have a solid answer for it, but the use of, or the idea of silence in this, what was that getting at, you think? Like, what was the advantage of her being a mute and the whole thing with Michael Shannon and his sort of eroticism for silence? Like, it, you know... What was it getting at?
Well, I think that the Michael Shannon thing was a little ham-fisted in there, but
I agree.
I don't know. I want there to be something significant there, but I don't know that there is. I mean, very obviously it makes her different from everybody else. She's able to communicate.
Right.
She's very strong. Like, she's got a... Like, Sally Hawkins is in always, but in general, but in this movie in particular, just has this sort of strange presence. And the fact that she's sort of mostly listening the entire time and communicates in a different way than everybody else makes her even more Interesting. For some reason, I took note this time around. When I watched it again, that scene when she picks up the fingers, after they've been, she finds them when she's cleaning up in the room, or in the lab, and she doesn't. She's not grossed out at all by it. Like, she just kind of picks them up and very deliberately puts them in this, you know, paper bag, and you know, I don't know. It's a weird moment. Like, she seems like very strong and powerful in that sense, or in that scene. And there is like a power to her. She's like a very small, physically small person, and is oftentimes sort of depicted in the visuals as being meek, but she's very, like, when she gets emotional, specifically towards the end, and especially in that scene with Richard Jenkins, when she's trying to convince him to, you know, help her free the creature, her emoting while communicating is so, it's, you know, you can't take her eyes off her, which goes back to that discussion we were having during the Quiet Place podcast, where you brought that up, Jeremy, that people who speak with sign language sort of command more of your attention anyways. Like, you have to be
right
focused on a different level, while speaking with someone like that. And I think, I don't know that Del Toro, he might have stumbled on that, with this character. I'm not sure, but yeah, like, it worked. I'm not really sure, where silence goes. You know, also there's really not much sound underwater, and there was a couple references that I noticed this time. It's amazing, like, how many things you miss on the first viewing, but like the fact that she was abandoned, like, she was orphaned and found by the water, and she had all those scratches on her neck, which are then, you know, turned into gills at the end of the movie. You know, like, I don't know if the idea early on was that she might just, maybe she is kind of an aquatic an aquatic being to begin with, you know?
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think that's the sign of a good storyteller. I mean, we talk about this all the time when you have that thought-provoking element, but not only that, like, it leaves a little bit of question on, like, you know, even though, you know, this fish man is obviously not set in reality, like, he's doing everything he can to create something realistic with it and with their relationship and with the fact that, you know, he pulls her into the canal and she doesn't drown. Like, you accept that, you know, she's gonna go live with him. And I think those questions that you were asking, Chapin, are what allow that to happen.
Yeah, I think the you know, how much you buy into the reality of it, is kind of inconsequential, really, because, like, this movie, unlike Pan's Labyrinth, for example, like, this movie, this is real. This is what's happening within the story you're watching. In Pan's Labyrinth, what all the fantastical elements are debatable as to whether they're in the young girl's mind or right, if they're happening. And,
well, only she can see him anyway.
Or yeah, only she can see it, or however you want to, you know, which does bring, you know, a sort of gravity to that movie that maybe the Shape of Water doesn't have, but I don't think it's a problem with the movie. And I think Del Toro is an amazing storyteller to just even be able to get away with creating this sort of a unique mashup is quite incredible. But for me, it was just taking time to try to figure out and to try to wrestle with what was that part of me that was just not buying into this, and that part of me that was honestly feeling like something was wrong or making me uncomfortable. And I think it has more to do with the tonal differences within the subject matters he's putting into this movie.
To me, I think what kept me from loving this movie was I really felt that I did not have any empathy or feeling for the fish guy, the monster. the creature.
Right.
And I think the movie, like, it depends very, it puts a lot of stock in you having some emotion for it.
Right.
And I didn't, like, I mean, he has no personality. He's sort of helplessly represented, and he's sort of scary at the beginning and then kind of becomes more helpless. And then, you know, he does have some enduring qualities that he kind of like puts on to his, you know, Richard Jenkins and Sally Hawkins. But that was a missing piece for me. It was a gap, you know?
You're absolutely right. And that was what I was saying before, too, is that, like, I bought into the relationship but never felt anything for it. And I think you said it well. I think he had no personality. And the weird thing is, like, Doug Jones, who plays this creature, is getting all sorts of praise, and he works with Del Toro a lot. And he was great in Pan's Labyrinth. He plays a couple of creatures in that movie, the Fawn in particular. But here, like, what did he bring? I think you're absolutely right. Like, that's a big missing piece here. If you don't feel for him, then you're not gonna, you know, you're not gonna feel for their relationship, and that's everything as far as the story goes. And that's why I put the love story third on my list of what this movie does well.
Yeah,
yeah, I agree, Chapin. I think that's like a huge part of also what's missing for me, and maybe if Del Toro had like concentrated a little bit more on that aspect of it and ignored some of the other like hand-fisted things he was trying to throw in there, he would have a bit of a more relatable, successful movie in that aspect.
Yeah, I definitely lay the blame at Del Toro's feet and not Doug Jones. I think Doug Jones can be a very emotive, physical actor, and you know, he, you know, essentially didn't have a face. I think most of the face was done with CGI, but
Well, what's frustrating is that, you know, you brought up the CGI, that there was that little bit with his face and his eyelids and stuff, but, you know, what's so great about some of Del Toro's work is that he doesn't create CGI creatures, Pacific Rim excluded, but you know, it's so much more intimate when you have a actor in a costume and in makeup. And, like, I don't think there's any chance in hell this movie would have worked if that character was 100% CGI. Sally Hawkins' performance wouldn't have been as good. I mean, so much would have changed. So he did the right thing in casting an actor to play that role, but forgot to write the role.
Yeah, I think that character needed to do something before the end to make a connection with the audience. I mean, obviously, it makes a difference in the end, but up until that point, he's just reacting to everything.
Agreed.
Ali, I know you were able to catch a few more Del Toro movies, or revisit or see for the first time. What did you watch, and what were your thoughts?
Yeah, so I watched Pan's Labyrinth, which I thought, interestingly enough, like, I liked a lot. But, you know, kind of, I don't know, it was very much the same experience as Shape of Water for me.
I enjoyed it a lot more.
I liked the story a lot more, which, again, as I mentioned, the story was my least favorite thing of Shape of Water. But
right.
And I don't know why. And I don't. I wish I. Had, I'm gonna get
the story. Name. The story was first in Pan's Labyrinth. It was about that story, that little girl, those characters,
yep,
and exactly. Everything else helped surround that. Whereas Shape of Water, I feel like it was everything else trying to develop a story.
And I don't know why. Sergi Lopez Vidal, the villain in that movie, is not listed among your top villains in cinema history. Like,
yeah, he's been forgotten to that sort of list for some reason.
Not like Pan's Labyrinth is a, you know, a little lost movie. That is a critical darling. Like, that got standing ovations at Cannes or Sundance or wherever.
And it should have.
So anyway, that, you know. But either way, Pan's Labyrinth is essentially a very similar project to Shape of Water, a creature feature, you know, dealing with the fantastical and the realities of some historical settings. I had seen Hellboy a long time ago. I don't remember a whole lot about it. I did like it, and I'm certainly not an advocate of comic book movies. I tried to watch Hellboy 2. It was on Netflix. I got about halfway through it, and it's enjoyable. Like, again, it's something that he does well, is he has, you know, actors playing the roles of these creatures. Doug Jones, again, is in it. I'm a big Ron Perlman fan. He's great as Hellboy. You know, the story launches into some ridiculousness, but it's pretty well laid out, and the script is strong. So, you know, those movies I like. I think the most interesting thing to discuss, though, that he has done is Pacific Rim, which is such a departure. You would never guess that he directed this movie. Are you guys familiar with this movie? I mean, I'm sure you've heard of it.
But yeah, I've seen it.
Just came out. You have seen it, Chapin?
Yeah.
So I liked it. I mean,
I liked it a lot. I thought it was great.
I mean, I wouldn't go so far as to say it was great, but like, the interesting thing is that like, there should be a place for movies like Pacific Rim. Like, it's absolutely absurd. Like, there is no reality to it, and it's just absolutely ridiculous. But there should be movies like that. Like, where else are we going to see that type of thing other than on the big screen, where, you know, CGI allows us to see it? But I think it is very hard to make it good, and the Pacific Rim is definitely bogged down by just like this overwhelmingly like big setting. Like, everything is so technical. Like, every room they walk into, there's computers and gadgets and stuff everywhere, and like, it's a little overwhelming. You know, it's a bit of a overwhelming on your senses. But ultimately, it comes down to the story was pretty good, and the stakes were there. They set them up. They created the characters, the character flaws, the character strengths, and they rolled with them. And I think it worked. I enjoyed it. It was a fun movie to watch. And I wish more movies like that could be of at least that caliber. I don't know that Pacific Rim, that movie, could be great. And I'm curious to hear, Chapin, if you disagree. But I think it was good.
Sorry, I disagree about what?
Like, you said you thought it was great.
Oh, maybe you're right. Not great. I mean, it was a lot of fun. But I think one thing I remember missing from it that you just brought up, Lee, about other Del Toro movies is our performances. And I don't know. I don't think any. I think it was weighed down by what you described earlier. The scale of it, and you miss some of those great performances from his movies. One thing I've always been fascinated by, you know, he was supposed to do and worked on for quite some time, the Hobbit movies,
yeah,
down in New Zealand for, with Peter Jackson's team, and that he, you know, and then eventually Peter Jackson took over for him because, they couldn't get the rights, or there was all that bullshit. I don't remember exactly what happened, but, and I think it would have been fascinating to see his take on that. I mean, it would have been fun to see him play with that kind of budget and those kind of resources, but also, you know, like, kind of a world that we know, reimagined through his imagination.
Yeah, I remember when, you know, the early talks of The Hobbit started, and, you know, there was all that word that Peter Jackson wasn't going to do them, and, you know, I think, you know, my initial reaction may have been, well, you know, I don't really want to see him if Peter Jackson's not going to do him. He did Lord of the Rings so well. But when I heard Guillermo del Toro, I thought that was perfect. And at the time, I had probably only seen Pan's Labyrinth. But yeah, I remember being very interested to see him direct those movies. And I wouldn't say I was disappointed that he didn't, but, you know, I'm with you, Chapin. I think it would have been interesting to see his take.
Yeah. So what is it? Are we missing something on this movie? I mean,
what do you mean?
Well, it won Best Picture. It did really, really well at the,
honestly,
the festivals. And
I think it goes into our next point or our next discussion.
Yeah.
I think it's more what you guys had brought up about Three Billboards that it's dealing with topics that are very relevant and topical right now. And, you know, it strikes, strikes a chord
plus,
with people.
Plus, it's Hollywood solving the world's problems, which is what we're going to hopefully move into next. And we can kind of explore other movies that do it. But I think eventually after this whole conversation of Shape of Water, it really comes down to, Lee, what we just talked about in comparison to, say, Pan's Labyrinth, is that all these different elements aren't there to serve the story.
The story's there to serve them.
The story has to fit into these elements for that movie to be made, whereas like Pan's Labyrinth, there's a story and these other elements get to serve it. And I think ultimately that's the bottom line of why Shape of Water for me doesn't totally work. So let's move into, Hollywood's love affair with itself.
I'm curious about this because I mean, this exists for sure, 100%. Like, there's a laundry list of movies that are examples of it, but I didn't see it too much with Shape of Water, so I thought it was interesting that you guys brought this up.
Oh, I definitely saw it with Shape of Water because, you have a monster who literally loves to watch movies for no apparent reason other than the self-referential aspect of it.
Yeah, and that's there, but that's his tribute to monster movies and things like that. Like, it's nothing in comparison to, like, La La Land and Hugo and, like...
Tribute to monster movies is the costume of this monster itself being from the creature from the Black Lagoon. It's almost like the same.
Well, it's more than that, too. I think, like, that,
That's the tribute, but then this monster goes ahead, and anytime he sees a screen, he needs to go and watch and try to figure out how to dance.
Right. Yeah, I also think, to my earlier question, I think I heard an interesting theory that I think one of the reasons why this movie's doing so well with the award, did so well with the Academy, certainly, was that, like, I think when this movie works, it involves like so many different departments. And I learned about like that, the Academy, the voting works really. And, not only does that mean, of course, you'll be nominated for a bunch of different awards, but, that people in those categories want to see those movies succeed. They want to see the movie that has set design. They want to see the movie that has, sound design and cinematography.
A marine department.
And so when people, and so when they vote for those things, they vote for the movie that, in their little category, it had some significance. It's not like Call Me By Your Name, which was, writing, directing, and acting, essentially. It's not like a movie that involved a ton of craftsmen, for example, whereas this one had the sets and the camera work and... all that other stuff.
Yeah, no, it's a great theory and it makes perfect sense. I mean, you have to look at who the Academy voters are, and if you're part of that voting process, you work within the industry in some, sense or another, and you know what it takes to make certain movies, and this movie's quintessential Hollywood. I mean, it was probably almost all shot on some soundstage somewhere, or at least 90% of it. And those sets are overwhelming, and they're clearly sets, like you said earlier, Chapin. And that's good. I mean, that serves the story that they're telling. But yeah, absolutely. I'm sure that's one of the big reasons that it did so well. I mean, you can make a movie that has all those elements, and then the movie doesn't come out even half as good as Shape of Water, and it's hard to justify, but you get one that has a good enough product, and you can be sure everyone's voting for that. So yeah, it's a good theory.
Another piece too is that, like, Hollywood on film or Hollywood in movies is is so intoxicating. Like, it's so illustrious, and it's not an accurate depiction of, you know, what making movies really is. And I think, you know, whether it's escapism for Academy voters, or whether it just draws a bigger audience because people like to watch movies about movies being made, and Hollywood and the glitz and the glamour, and the beginning of Mulholland Drive comes to mind, where Naomi Watts shows up and she's, you know, ready to be a Hollywood actress and everything's great, and then, you know, it spirals into, you know, her life kind of turning into a mess. And, you know, but you think about movies like La La Land, which is, you know, paints this, you know, perfect picture of what Hollywood looks like. And then even movies like The Player, you know, that just looks so fun looking back on old, old studios and things like that. And I
almost feel like the Player is almost anti-Hollywood, though.
It jokes on it a little bit, but it's still, I mean, it's,
it takes place within the world, but I feel like it's,
yeah, but it's still a pat on its own back. I mean, it definitely plays off of like the Hollywood cliches. Yeah. But it's still
and
sort
I
of.
I don't have, you know, and I think there's nothing, absolutely nothing inherently wrong with Hollywood being in love with itself.
No, I love these types of movies.
I just think it's been getting a bad rap the last few years because you have Shape of Water, which won Best Picture. You have La La Land, which almost won Best Picture.
One for a minute. Argo won Best Picture.
Yeah,
Artist.
Argo, The Artist, Hugo. Birdman, that's another one that won over Boyhood, because and that's about
interesting
the entertainment.
Interesting you bring business. That up, because that's a movie that did that. I remember, Chapin, we talked about that. That's a movie that kind of merged that reality and fantasy element that just didn't work for me, and normally I like, but right. You know, in a very different sort of way than Shape of Water and Del Toro does it, but
yeah, then I mean, there's some of my favorite movies too. You know, you have, like you mentioned, The Player or Sunset Boulevard or Cinema Paradiso, all these movies that are amazing. So I don't think there's, like I said, I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with it. I think the problem comes when it seems like Hollywood's patting itself on the back for solving issues that it can't really solve.
Well, and it goes to the fact that, like, the Oscars themselves are Hollywood just literally mm-hmm. patting themselves on the back, and then they award
right.
the movie,
and then on top
about,
of that, yeah.
yeah. award the movie about,
about
themselves.
How amazing yeah. Hollywood is. Yeah,
so, like,
and
what
that's what irks
and,
people.
And then they try to tell us that it's because it's an allegory for, you know, the yeah. trying times we're going through this year.
And The Shape of Water, I think, is a perfect example of that, what we just described.
Yeah, it's hard not to call a topic Hollywood's love affair with itself without it having yeah. a negative connotation.
Right. But then you to look at, like, those great films and, you know, Sunset Boulevard and Cinema Paradiso, and you have all those movies, and
yeah,
although Cinema
my favorite,
Paradiso
yeah.
isn't really Hollywood, but...
yeah, but that's a huge love affair with movies.
With like, movies, yeah, yeah. Like, that's the whole thing. And we can't forget how important La La Land was to restoring jazz culture for America, so we have to thank it for
yeah,
that.
Thanks
especially
a lot.
For white people. All right, moving on to our top five underwater scenes, in water scenes that have water running.
Yes. let's go over what our
I guess criteria come will need to come first.
Well, I guess I can go first, seeing how I might have done it a little differently. I called this my Jaws Memorial List.
As did I.
By the way. But really, I called it top five scenes in water. And my biggest thing was the person had to be soaked from head to toe. It couldn't be just somebody sitting by a pool or it raining outside. They have to be completely drenched the entirety of the scene.
Gotcha.
So that being said, being completely drenched the entirety of the scene is my number five is every time John Cusack is outside in High Fidelity.
It had to be a John Cusack movie. Something with John Cusack. He's always in the rain.
Yeah.
Yeah, he has to be apparently in soaking, downpouring rain, you know, spousing his heart out.
Yeah, he did that a lot.
I mean, I love that movie, so I'm not really making fun of it, but it is ridiculous.
It is. Once you point that out, though, it's ridiculous.
I think even in those cases, like, that movie is aware of itself enough that it, I think it does that in jest. Don't you agree?
Yeah, I would agree with that.
I'm going to give it that credit so I don't have to think anything poorly of it.
Lee, you should go.
Ooh, Chapin's not done with
no,
his
I'm stuff. Done. I'm done.
all right, so my criteria was that the camera had to be underwater for a part of the scene. So,
okay.
As a result, oftentimes here what it was filming was also underwater, but the camera had to be submerged. My number five may be a exception to that, only because I'm not totally sure this wasn't done in post, most of this scene. In fact, I know a lot of it was done in post.
Dry for wet.
yeah. But it's a scene in Life of Pi, a movie I didn't particularly like, but the visuals were stunning. And it's kind of this, like, the scene where he's looking underwater and he's seeing basically the boat go down and all the animals kind of going out and just kind of like drifting off into the abyss. And just visually, it's such a cool scene. There's a lot of scenes in that movie that just are fun to watch because they just look great. Again, the movie I didn't particularly love, but.
All right. My number five. So mine had to be all completely underwater. Cause I thought it was
camera, actor, everything. Oh wow! Are there scenes like that?
So my number five is the classic fight at the end of Thunderball, which is like some people have made fun of because it's like 30. It is kind of funny once you look at it in the context. It's like 30 guys in scuba gear from the 60s fighting underwater, and like how exciting could that possibly be? But I think it actually is. It's kind of incredible to see how they were able to do that back then. Do you guys remember that scene?
No.
I haven't seen any of the old ones.
Oh, pathetic. Well, moving on.
I have, but I
no, it's
I
cool.
Don't
like, there's like the bad guys and the good guys, and there's literally like 30 people in this scene, like, you know, cutting each other's hoses and, you know, things like that. Yeah.
Nice.
All right, Jeremy.
All right, my number four, and this is more of a nostalgic childhood pick, but there's a scene from the Disney version of Robin Hood where Robin Hood's trying to get away, and he jumps into the water, into like a swamp, and they shoot arrows in there, and everyone thinks he's dead, but he takes one of those, I don't know what they're called, reefs or not, whatever. There's these little plants that are hollow in the middle. He uses that to breathe, and that he survives that way. And I always remember that. I always like kept that in the back of my mind
in case
I was ever in that situation where I needed to get underwater and there's a hollow reef around.
We're going to find Jeremy dead. They're going to be like...
Oh, yeah. I'll be blowing into a branch. I'll have a branch down my throat. You'll know why.
It's good that we had this podcast. We'll be able to explain some things.
Yeah.
All right. My number four, a movie that recently, I can't remember which top five it was, but came up on a top five, from Apocalypto, The Water Birth.
That's a good one.
The mother and her child is, they're trapped in the well, and it's raining, and the water's getting higher and higher, and she gives birth, to add to the pleasantness.
Yeah.
Wow, yeah, good pull.
All right, my number four is a movie called, have you guys heard of this movie, Into the Blue?
Into the Blue.
Oh, is that the, it's no, a shark it's movie,
with
right?
with Paul Walker no, that's Deep and Blue Sea. Jessica
that's
Alba.
Deep Blue Sea.
Great cast.
It's Scott Conn. Oh, my God.
It's Scott Conn. Oh, my God.
So this is, I mean, look, not a great movie, but surprisingly decent. And the underwater stuff in this movie is so good. It just has incredible underwater footage. I'm a diver. I've done diving before. I'm not a diver. I am certified to dive. And so it's cool to like go back and.
That was such a, you know, when you're in film school and people introduce themselves as a writer. I'm a writer. I'm a director.
But this is, it's actually kind of, it's a silly movie, but like anchored by this like really nice cool underwater footage. A lot of those guys do their own stunts. And of course, Jessica Alba in a bikini never hurt anybody.
All right. So my number three is another one where the person's just soaked because of a giant storm. And it is when Lieutenant Dan is at the top of the mast.
Oh, that's
and,
a good pick.
In Forrest Gump yelling at the storm.
All right, I'm going to see Chapin's Into the Blue with The Graduate. Sound of Silence scene in the pool.
That's also my number three.
Yeah, I thought about that one, but...
Yeah, it was one that I was like, this is sort of an obvious pick. You know, that's speaking of movies we don't really talk about a lot, I don't think. But the way that the song plays in that scene and kind of like, you know, speaking of silence, and we've obviously spent a lot of time talking about that in the last few weeks, you know, that movie really kind of does such a great job of, like, you know, alienating that character.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, just that idea that when he just goes underwater, he's, like, trying to get away from all his parents, friends questioning him,
yeah.
And it's just, like, an escape, and it's a nice use of water in that sense.
Yeah, no, it's a good pick. All right, so my number two, we've already mentioned this movie on this podcast, but it is the beginning of Sunset Boulevard.
Yeah, I thought
with
about that.
Our main character dead in a pool, giving us his voiceover of what just happened.
So unrealistic.
What the?
Give me Shape of Water. Give me something I can believe.
So there you go, Billy Wilder making an appearance on the list.
Yeah, honorable mention for me. All right, my number two, another movie I've mentioned recently, but it is the one of many, but specifically one dive scene in Das Boot when they're going deeper and deeper to try to avoid the bombs that are being dropped from above, and they're just looking at the pressure. Every now and then you cut outside the submarine and see the shot of it diving. But mostly you're just confined in that space as they're watching the pressure build, and they're hearing the sound of basically the pressure pushing the sides of the submarine. It's so claustrophobic. I love that movie. It's done so well. And while, I guess, technically in the submarine, that camera's probably not submerged, so it doesn't meet my criteria. What's my number two?
Number two is from not a great movie, but one that that is kind of a special place in my heart is from the kitchen swimming scene in Alien Resurrection.
Yeah, I saw that come up. I never saw that one. So the one
I haven't seen.
Strange. I like it, but it's a strange one. But that scene is pretty incredible. It kind of just amazes me that people are, you know, they're able to do that kind of work. Like that you're able to film people. Yeah,
underwater.
It just seems like so challenging to me. And Especially in that one, they don't really use any doubles. It's like they're doing close-ups. They're filming it as you would any other movie. And, yeah, it's pretty incredible.
All right, so my number one is the scene where the dude's taking a bath and they come in and throw a ferret in his bathtub and then piss on his rug. So, yeah, that's wins
great.
For me.
That's a great one.
Yep, that's a good scene. My number one is from Saving Private Ryan, the very beginning of the Omaha Beach scene when they're running in one. And they got the shots underwater, the bullets going through. And then in particular, the shot where it's just bouncing up above water and then back down. I was just showing you guys that, by the way, with my hand.
I noticed.
Yeah. And the way he uses sound there, like it comes above water and you hear everything and then you're back down and it's quiet. It's just a, you know, just an example of the brilliance of that movie.
Yeah, no, that's a great pick.
Great one.
I mean, it really, like, it's one of those, like, cinematic moments where you just, you're the camera and you feel like you're the camera. You know, from everything you see and the way you visually see those bullets go through the water.
Yep.
Yeah, it's just great filmmaking. Janusz.
My number one is the Mary Master Antonio death scene in The Abyss.
Yeah, I was hoping you would have that, Chapin, because I don't remember that movie well enough. Obviously, it all takes place underwater.
Shame on you. Yeah, it's a.
I like
it. It's an amazing movie, especially when you consider what I just brought up about the last one. That whole movie was just, you know, like they had never been done before, and I don't think anything's been done since like it. It was pretty incredible.
All right, so thanks for listening, guys. This is the...
And girls.
Guys and girls. This has been another edition of the Get Your Film Fix podcast. We got some big ones coming up. We're approaching the 100th episode. So hopefully we'll have something a little extra special for that. Don't get your hopes up.
We're not even going to promise our A-game.
Yeah, I mean, we'll do our best, you know, you've listened to the podcast.
After 99 episodes, you must know what to expect.
I'm staying. I'm finishing my coffee. Enjoying my coffee.